hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. We have another wonderful show for you this week, and I had a great week spending some time over the Labor Day weekend with Alex Jones and Owen Schroyer down at InfoWars in the War Room studio in Austin, Texas. They're terrific journalists, a great and progressive crew. I did talk to Alex ahead of time because I know he can really get into conspiracies and conspiracy theories, and just asked him, let's go over the data about where we are with COVID-19. So much to talk about. Let me give you just a little bit of what we covered.
Well, you've seen him all over Fox News. I've seen him all over other national media. He's very well spoken. Dr. Peter McCullough, academic physician from Dallas, my hometown. And he drove down here to graciously be with us in studio. He'll be with us 30 minutes into the next hour. Then I'm going to get into a special report on the left and how they are under mass psychosis and some of the studies and documentation of that. Then the War Room, 3 p.m. Central today. Dr. Peter McCullough is here. He wants to get into vaccine failure. He wants to get into now we know what these supposed shots are doing and where he thinks it's all going. But also, he wants to get into some censorship. First, you've seen big tech go around and block Senator Rand Paul when he says things they don't like, even though it's true that natural immunity is better than vaccine immunity. Donald Trump censored off Twitter. I mean, this is so dangerous. And the big group they're trying to silence is doctors and scientists and nurses. So, Dr. Peter McCullough, thank you so much. AmericaOutLoud.com. And you do your great McCullough report as well. Thanks for coming in, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm going to try to give you the floor because you're a very well-spoken guy and you're on a lot of other shows, a lot of other guests, usually have 5 minutes or whatever. Where do you want to start first?
Well, by introduction, I'm an academic internist and cardiologist in Dallas, Texas. I see patients every week. I'm the editor of two major journals that are cited by the National Library of Medicine. I'm the senior associate editor of the longest-standing journal in cardiology. And as many of your listeners know, I've dedicated the last year and a half to COVID-19. In a sense, I've done a self-directed fellowship in infectious disease and in COVID-19. And as you implied, I've been subject to censorship as many other academic physicians have, largely because we are publicly participating in a topic of national importance. And this is very, very critical. In a time like this, we need many doctors and we need many scientists to put their ideas together to help guide America forward. And that's one of the reasons why myself and others are frequent commentators on national media programs like this one. And unfortunately, my healthcare system in Dallas is suing me personally related to issues in a separation agreement, but I am declaring no opinions on behalf of any affiliation or organization. My opinions are only those of myself, as they are with any doctor in any scientific discourse.
And again, the group you're with, my family's used, really respected, really loved, but you don't even want their name said. You've never brought them in. And the idea that you, as a family man, as a doctor, as a respected academic, the fact that you're not supposed to have speech in America, that's preposterous. Since when? It's not like you're in the CIA and you violated some non-disclosure. It's not like you told them what's going on. It's Scott and White.
All we're doing is discussing the data. And one of the things that I want your fact checkers who watch your show and they follow me carefully, have them fact check every single citation I'm going to give today over the next few minutes, because all we're going to do is talk about scientific data and apply the results to the path forward in the pandemic.
Give us a prelude and then please get into it. You're gracious to be here, sir. As millions are watching right now, millions will watch later when it's archived, of what you want to lay out in the next hour and 25 minutes.
I think one of the biggest topics, and it's really of public health importance, is that the COVID-19 vaccines that were so heavily leveraged and relied upon in our federal response to the pandemic are failing. And patients who are fully and partially vaccinated are contracting COVID-19, and we got to talk about them.
What are some of the other areas you want to get into?
I think we really should cover the issue of what's called early sequence multi-drug therapy, because it applies to both those vaccinated and unvaccinated who are at high risk and develop COVID-19.
All right, you'll have the floor when we come back. We've got 5-6 minutes to break. Let me ask you a few questions. What do you make of Australia saying up to 5 shots a year? Israel now saying a 4th shot, maybe a 5th or 6th every year. Pfizer's talking about therapeutic pills you're going to take. And now they're saying they want smartphones to document you're taking your pills daily. It sounds like the drug companies are literally involved in a hostile takeover. Trump said last week on national TV that, yeah, Pfizer basically had more power when he was president than he did.
There's a real clear theme of progressive loss of medical freedom tied to progressively reduced personal freedom. And we know from these vaccine platforms, there were 24 of them, messenger RNA and adenoviral DNA platforms. None of them were actually designed to be vaccines. They were designed to be genetic transfer technology programs with intermittent injections.
Wow, it's just amazing. And I remember reading, I'm no doctor like you, but I remember 18 months ago, Gates is like, well, you'll need a lot of boosters. And then I went and looked it up and they go, yeah. The chief scientist in England over their big government lab there, he goes, well, these are really gene therapies. He's for it. And he's saying, you'll need one every 5 or 6 months. I mean, they're admitting it and then playing dumb like it's a new thing.
Well, gene transfer technology for most individuals is a form of the common cold is certainly not justified. I can tell you this much, that a definition of a successful vaccine is it would at least have to last a year, at least a year, and it would have to have 50% protection. And what we know now is that the Israeli health minister has Pfizer fully vaccinated at 39% protection. Purinek and colleagues from the Mayo Clinic large study has Pfizer at 42% protective. And then the Imperial College of London with the REACT study group has Pfizer at 44% protection. And so there's no secret why Pfizer basically is a non-viable failing vaccine and is first up for now boosters into a failing commercial product.
And we've still got 4 minutes to break. So Dr. McCullough, please start now. You wanted to get into vaccine failure first.
Well, the CDC is telling us, and I think this is really important for Americans to know, the CDC has on its website a total of thousands of cases of fully vaccinated Americans who are failed and they're in the hospital. They have a paper out by Havers and colleagues from the CDC in the month of June. They had of those hospitalized in America with COVID-19, 23.4% were partially or fully vaccinated. We know from a posting on the CDC website in late August that 70 to 80% of those who died with COVID-19 that were fully vaccinated were over age 65. So unfortunately, the people who need the vaccinations the most are not having the vaccines pull through for them.
And people could say, well, if you look at Israel, if 90% are vaccinated, of course, most people in the hospital are going to be vaccinated. But in the old days, most vaccines pretty much worked. Since when does the immunity go away in just a few months?
Well, in Israel, we had a pre-vaccination curve to look at. So that was very clear. You could see the height of the curve. Anybody can go to Worldometer or any one of these COVID tracker websites and look at the pre-vaccination curve. Now look at the post-vaccination curve with essentially all eligible adults vaccinated in Israel. The post-vaccination curve, the Delta curve, is larger than the pre-vaccination curve. So there, in many ways, the vaccine has made the outbreak worse, and this was predicted by many experts in the field.
Wow, we're going to go to break in a minute and a half, but please continue.
We know more that a paper that just hit New England Journal of Medicine by Keener and colleagues from the University of California at San Diego, where they had 83% of healthcare workers fully vaccinated, they now have more vaccinated cases, 94, compared to unvaccinated cases of healthcare workers getting COVID-19. An example, we're here in the healthcare arena where there's vaccine mandates across health systems in the United States. It's actually making it worse that we were better off before mass vaccination.
And again, I'm not a respected doctor and an academic like you, but I can look at the curves here. All over the world, as they get the first shot, the second shot, suddenly mass hospitalizations, mass deaths, illnesses trailing right after. So it's like I pull a trigger, with a 308 shoot a deer at 100 yards. I watch the deer fall over. I watch him take the shot. I watch them fall over. I mean, I'm not a rocket scientist, but this looks bad, Doctor.
Sure. We have Israel. We have Gibraltar, Singapore, Iceland, United Kingdom. United Kingdom does some of the best data analyses that we have. We have the technical briefing September 3rd. 492,528 cases of Delta, 55.4% are vaccinated.
Doc, stay there. Start over on this. This is huge. When we come back, and I've got some of the graphs out of Israel, out of Gibraltar, out of Singapore that you mentioned, when we come back. And he is the host of the McCullough Report, McCullough Report. Find it at AmericaOutloud.com. And he's fighting hard for all of us. Well, I tell you, I don't like going to break with this guy because he's saying amazing stuff. Dr. Peter McCullough, AmericanOutlaw.com. He is with us, and I've got all the graphs out of Israel showing right after they got the shots, first, second, third, exploding. He's got all the statistics, and he was telling me how really serious Delta is. Now last year I said, hey, this is overblown. There's people that die of car wrecks are saying have it. This mutation, which I think came from the vaccinated, is super deadly and super bad, and he was just telling me how bad it is, and I don't need him to tell me. I believe him. I experienced it, my family and my crew, and around Austin. So please continue, Doctor, and repeat what you said.
No, I agree. I underestimated Delta as well. I was on national TV a couple times mentioning that it was going to be more mild, and it is true. It has a lower case fatality rate than the other versions, and this is shown in the UK variant report, even up to September 3rd. But it's largely because younger people get it, but the younger people who get it, it's a difficult illness.
But it's way more contagious, right?
And it's way more contagious. And let me tell you, we've always had Delta. We've always had about a dozen different variants. And what happened was during the pre-vaccinated era, there was an ecological diversity. And when we started vaccinating, we basically allowed a dominant variant to come forward. And this actually started in India, out of Mashra, where they started using the Sinovac vaccine in a couple of spots there. And once we get a dominant mutant to go forward, it finds a way of walking on the vaccines.
Take your time and explain. It's in all the literature that these live vaccines or whatever, you're the doctor, create these dominant mutants, just like in chickens, and you get this Marek disease.
Yes, that's exactly right. So what happened is, with using the CoronaVac or Sinovac vaccine, which is a whole virus killed vaccine, that it creates an environment where the diversity of the different strains reduces. And a paper from Mayo Clinic in Boston by Neeson and colleagues showed when you get to about 25% vaccinated in a population, you're no longer going to have ecological diversity, and it will narrow. What happened in the United States following India and the UK is we went from about 2% Delta early in the spring to most recent estimates, end of August by CDC, 99.1% Delta.
Wow.
We've never had 99% of a single strain in the United States. That is a product of vaccination changing the ecological diversity of the variant.
Explain how that works.
It turns out that in a paper by Fahrenholt, another one by Venkata Krishnan, and then actually by our CDC director getting on TV, Americans learned that the Delta variant, which has seven mutations in the spike protein, several in the nucleocapsid, it has basically achieved antigenic escape. What that means is that the antibodies that are raised by the vaccines cannot hit the virus and can't hit it well enough to stop it. And that's the reason why, for instance, Delta is having such an easy time with Pfizer. Now, Pfizer's 30 micrograms per shot. It's the weakest of all the vaccines. Moderna is 100 micrograms of messenger RNA per shot. Moderna's holding up a bit better in the PureNext study from Mayo Clinic at 72% protection with Delta. Johnson & Johnson, we don't know. But I can tell you it's clear at 99.1% Delta, it is all about Delta. Delta appears to be beating the vaccines. The vaccines are not being adjusted to cover Delta. And if we have any type of booster that comes in sooner than a year, that's basically a marker of a failed vaccine.
Now, how did you and so many other doctors a year ago, year and a half ago, predict it would fail, predict it would cause all these problems? And then why do you think, I know you like to speculate, would the establishment go forward with something they knew would be a fiasco?
Linus Pauling predicted it a long time ago. Linus Pauling said, listen, don't try to vaccinate for the common cold. Why? Because we have a respiratory virus. It is going to use the nasal and oral pharyngeal air passages for its initial touchdown in the human body. that's not well protected by systemic vaccines. We know that the lymph nodes and IgA and the other components of the immune system up in the nose and mouth are not well juiced by a vaccine that goes in the arm. The other reason why we knew this is that coronaviruses are a family of common cold viruses, and prior attempts at trying to vaccinate against them have failed. To make matters worse, it wasn't that it was chose a live attenuated or a killed vaccine, which has been tried and failed, or a pure protein vaccine, which is still on the way. Instead, the decision was a genetic vaccine. And the genetic vaccines have a dangerous mechanism of action. They trick the body's cells into producing the dangerous Wuhan spike protein, the original wild-type spike protein. This spike protein is the product of gain-of-function research out of the Wuhan lab, and now the human body is tricked into producing it by synthetic messenger RNA, which has very strong nucleoside analog caps, which don't allow the messenger RNA to be broken down very easily, or the adenoviral DNA, which comes in billions and billions of particles through the J&J vaccine. What you need to know is we've never had a vaccine before that distributed to the brain, that distributed to the heart and the other vital organs, and then set up shop in producing a dangerous foreign protein in our own body.
And that was my next question, because, again, I use layman terms. I just knew that, like, the polio vaccine they're using is the number one cause of polio because it's a live virus vaccine. Then I talked to other scientists, and I read the reports. This genetic system, I understand, is a genetic vaccine, so it's like synthetic, or correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just saying that sounds closer to a live virus vaccine because it does go into your body and produce a synthetic copy. So it sounds similar to that. So I'm trying to understand how it's creating variants or how it's shedding if it's not a live virus.
No, it's different because in a live attenuated, let's say even a replication incompetent, you're getting exposed to the entire virus. That would be like the inactivated flu. But the point is, here, we actually have the genetic code for the worst part of the virus going into our cells. Our cells produce this protein in an uncontrolled fashion for an uncontrolled duration of time. It's expressed on the cell surface, which is wrong. And then the body attacks its own cells because it recognizes the spike protein.
And you and others warned of that over a year ago. So why the hell did the system do this?
I published an op-ed in the Hill this summer before all this took off. And the title of the paper was The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program. And, you know, I didn't predict all of it, but I said, you know what? This looks very, very much to be a gamble. We are putting all of our eggs in one basket. There was a defocus on early and late treatment. We were hyper-focusing on fear, isolation, lockdowns, wearing a mask, and waiting to be saved by a vaccine. There was almost this vaccine prep that was going on from a psychological perspective. And then when these vaccines were rolled out, there was really weren't too many questions asked. Like, what is this stuff? How long does it last in the human body? And so we learned everything after the fact. For instance, a paper from Ogata and colleagues from Harvard shows the spike protein circulates in the human body for 2 weeks afterwards. We know this spike protein damages blood cells. It damages blood vessels, cells, endothelial cells, and causes thrombosis and blood.
So is it true that it can shed and infect others?
It's true that the Chinese have shown the whole virus gets into sweat, it gets into oropharyngeal and urogenital secretions, and it makes sense the spike protein, a subunit of the virus, clearly would be in these body secretions, and shedding probably does occur. I can tell you clinically, the most significant shedding I've ever seen clinically is a recipient of the shedding event that the young person expressed shingles, as an example, or can change menstrual periods or feel somewhat ill.
That's what we've seen in the news is people that have partners that took it are getting rashes.
Right. And so, in fact, it was basically close contact, sexual contact. So it's reasonable advice based on what's known. No close contact for about 4 weeks with a vaccinated individual.
Wow. Doctor, stay there. This is incredible. I want you to go wherever you want. We come back into the vaccine failure, where you think this goes and what you think is going to happen now that this is all coming out. I mean, the world's learning about this. This thing's falling apart.
Well, you heard it there. Alex Jones is terrific. He was fun to work with, and he's got that big bullfrog voice, and he has a large conservative audience in the United States, but he clearly wants to know and he wants to learn. I sat at the desk with him. He had easily 20 piles of printouts of information. And I had asked him, I said, Alex, do you read all that? And he said, I sure do. I read all of it every day. And he processes a lot of information and puts together a show. One of the things that's come up in the last week that's brought great concern is we've had now for a week or two hanging over us a statement from the Federation of State Medical Boards about COVID-19 misinformation, particularly regarding the vaccine, and the medical licensing boards saying that they were going to go after doctors who were giving COVID-19 what they had determined misinformation, particularly about the vaccines. And now the American Board of Internal Medicine and the related boards, boards of pediatrics, for instance, have said the same thing, to go after doctors' boards' certifications. And this is particularly alarming. You can imagine I'm doing a lot of work out here working with you and my listeners to go over the data. You can see how pinpoint I was with respect to the citations of the data, really just trying to get information into the hands of the listeners. In everything I mentioned, I try to give the first author a citation largely to give you a roadmap to find these articles, to fact check it yourself, and then move forward. But I do have concerns, like any other doctor who's willing to speak out against the narrative. Now, Alex Jones's nice program he put together on InfoWars, it said Dr. McCullough destroys a narrative. I'm not sure I did. But in follow-up to the Federation of State Medical Boards and the American Board of Internal Medicine, in a sense, a threat against doctors who are engaging in scientific discourse on COVID-19, article was published by Robert Montoya, September 9th, 2021. And the title of the article was in the Texas Scoreboard periodical, Texas Medical Board Responds to Concerns About Punishing Vaccine-Hesitant Doctors. And it states that standing with Texans wanting to protect medical free speech, Senator Bob Hall, who's a Republican from Edgewood, Texas, asked the Texas Medical Board if they would punish doctors sharing concerns about COVID-19 vaccinations. He wasn't satisfied with their answer. Hall fired off a letter to the Texas Medical Board last month, and after reading this alarming statement from the Federation of State Medical Boards that I just mentioned, Hall asked the Texas Medical Board President Sharif Zafran to clarify that Texas doctors who voice concerns over COVID-19 vaccines won't be punished, and that the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact of House Bill 1616 won't be misconstrued for such purposes. And Hall goes on to engage in a dialogue with Zafran, and one of the responses that Zafran came back was, in quotes, "Part of protecting the public's health, safety, and welfare is the TMB's recognition that physicians must have the ability to freely discuss treatment options with their patients so that together they can make decisions that are in the best interest of the patient." He continued, "Physicians are expected to follow a standard of care in providing, recommending, or not recommending any preventions or treatments. As always, the TMB would just remind physicians to be sure to provide appropriate disclosures to their patients and adequately document these in the patient medical record." I think all of that's fair. Doctors really don't have a role in either recommending or not recommending the COVID-19 vaccines because of the fact that the vaccines are offered free of charge and through a voluntary program where patients go into vaccine centers. And more frequently now, with half the nation vaccinated, the other half resisting vaccination, it's more common that people, in a sense, are forced into vaccination with an employer mandate or a mandate from school or another organization. And I am inundated with the request for guidance on how to navigate these vaccine mandates. No one seems to want them. No one seems to understand where they came from. And yet they're wrestling with the threats of losing a job or being de-enrolled from school or other professional pathways. So one approach, and I gave my approach at a medical freedom presentation this week in Salt Lake City, Utah, was that to apply for both full medical and religious exemptions. And what I mean by a medical exemption is that baseline medical conditions that increase the risk of bad things happening with a vaccine are common. So for instance, if there's underlying heart disease then myocarditis with the Pfizer or Moderna messenger RNA vaccines could have greater consequences. It would make sense. People have a history of drug allergies in the past, allergies to prior vaccinations. Those who are polyallergic, we've had over 24,000 serious allergic reactions to the COVID-19 vaccine. Not of all of them are fully anticipated ahead of time. If they were, patients wouldn't have received the vaccine. So it's obvious we don't understand all the determinants of vaccine reactions. And so the risks of vaccine reactions are evident and should be evident in many individuals. And then lastly, those with blood disorders, those with hypertension, they are really a setup for severe hypertensive events, having underlying problems with the blood system, including what's called vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpura, or VITT. All of these have to be taken into consideration. So many patients recruited into the vaccine clinical trials were well that we really didn't have a test run of these vaccines in people with common medical conditions. And now that they're being rolled out to a reluctant and unwilling population, I think the rates of vaccine injuries are going to skyrocket if these vaccines are, in a sense, forced or mandated on the population. We did hear in the last week that our president of the United States came out with even stronger language regarding vaccine mandates, doubling down into what is obviously a failing vaccine scenario where our Delta curve is not being controlled with the vaccines. We're seeing vaccine failures being reported in the thousands, and we're seeing the continued rate of vaccine injuries, which are astronomical, including those requiring hospitalization or that have caused death. The vaccines have not been adjusted to the Delta variant, and that's, I think, well understood. So anybody taking a vaccine now cannot expect to have coverage against Delta, and then moving into another short cycle of getting boosters, which again haven't been just adjusted for Delta. What's on the horizon that could be helpful? One is the Novavax vaccine, which is a purified protein vaccine in a matrix, and that's the spike protein. If it can be adjusted to cover Delta or just be more diverse, have more epitopes or binding sites for the antibodies to hit, we could end up with a much better vaccine. It's done with the pneumococcal vaccine, where it now has, I think, 23 different sites for vaccine for antibodies to hit. It's a very intelligent vaccine. No matter what came forward, if Novavax came forward, in my view, it would be strictly limited to seniors, those at the highest risk, as well as those dealing with our seniors. It should not be broadly applied across the population, certainly not younger individuals. Anybody with a less than 1% risk of hospitalization and death for COVID-19, in my view, the risks of a vaccine do not outweigh the risk of the vaccine outweigh the potential benefits. And it's fairly clear, and people under age 50 get through COVID-19 with a less than 1% risk of hospitalization and death. And vaccines under any circumstances should be purely elective, and no one under any circumstances should receive any pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal regarding an experimental COVID-19 vaccine, which at this point in time cannot be considered to be either effective or safe enough for general use. I want to pick up a little bit more after the break and spend a little bit more time with the InfoWars War Room team before we get into our interview this week. So let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. You know, HealthyCell is a terrific lineup of products. They have products that are pill-free, gel-pack vitamins. Looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out HealthyCell, the leading innovator in nutritional supplements for cell health. HealthyCell has a product that helps REM sleep, helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with HealthyCell's REM sleep supplement. The only sleep supplement that's designed to support all stages of sleep. And boy, is it needed now during all the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic. So go to HealthyCell.com and use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any product from HealthyCell. I use them every day. I believe in them, and you should too. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Let's get real, let's get loud, on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. And as I promised, I wanted to give you just another brief window into the InfoWars War Room studio in Austin, Texas, where I had a chance to work with both Alex Jones and with Owen Schroyer. So I met with Owen for the 5 o'clock hour, and this is where we picked up.
I am honored to be joined by Dr. Peter McCullough, who is one of the brave voices coming out of our healthcare system, calling out the truth about COVID and the vaccines and all of it. He's going to be with us for the remainder of the hour. But he was really interested in that lady that we just played. She seems like she's pretty smart. I think she should be the doctor, Doc, not you.
Well, I tell you, we're in a crazy world right now. There's no doubt about it.
But as you were saying, and this was my frustrating point about it and why I really played the video, not to torture people with that content. Believe me, I know it's not comfortable seeing that. But is it not true that everything she says is the complete opposite of reality?
That's almost where we are right now. And I can tell you that the whole idea, for instance, of taking a vaccine is to protect oneself. We always take vaccines just like we would take a medicine. It's just for us. It's not for anybody else.
And so that's the one thing, is she blames everybody else because she's unhealthy and unhappy. That is just a whole nother problem. But then she's blaming unvaccinated people on creating these variants, whether it's the Delta or the Mu or Lambda or whatever else they're saying. But how can they not see the common sense or just the basic logic of, wait a second, we had this virus out for almost a year, not a single variant, and then right after the vaccines come out, we have all these different variants. I mean, that should be common sense.
Well, just to clarify, we have a pre-vaccination era where we had really an array of different strains. So the virus replicates, it's gonna make mistakes, and so it ends up with an array of, you know, ecologically natural strains, just like you have different hair color, I have different hair color, we're different. So the virus does that, but when we apply a vaccination, what it does is it allows what's called a selective non-lethal pressure to have the emergence of a dominant variant, which is obvious what's gone on. We've gone from 14 different strains to now a single dominant mutant. CDC tells us we're 99.1% Delta. We've never had that before. So now we're in a tsunami of Delta. Why? Because Delta has found a way to get past the vaccines.
From your perspective, how much of what the CDC is saying do you actually trust?
The CDC gives us mixed information, and its website is a treasure trove of information. For example, the CDC in the month of August has told us about thousands of vaccine failures, thousands hospitalized and those who have died.
Well, that's what's so frustrating, is the CDC talks about how the mask caused bacterial pneumonia, talks about how the masks don't even stop COVID. It shows with the VAERS report, which is maybe 10% of what the actual numbers are, all of the vaccine side effects or even deaths. But yet when you hear from the CDC directors or they get interviewed, officials in publications like the Washington Post and New York Times, it's like, are they even going off their own data? Are they even seeing their own data?
I think the CDC is overwhelmed. The CDC has never attempted to do a mass public vaccination program. They are receiving many-fold increased safety reports on the vaccines. The CDC is assuming a role that they really don't have. You know, keep in mind that the CDC, the FDA, and the NIH serve us. They are public servants. They serve doctors. They're supposed to analyze data and serve us. The doctor sits above the CDC, NIH, and FDA with the patient. The doctor and the patient have the fiduciary relationship. Now we're in a situation. I had an interview one time, and somebody asked me about what did they think about the most recent CDC ruling. And you know what I asked them? Ruling, is the CDC a Supreme Court, or are they a public health agency that's providing basic support information for us?
And of course, the ruling is not something they're supposed to do at all. They're just supposed to share data, or a doctor is supposed to use the CDC as kind of a source of data and information. And, you know, that was something you brought up earlier with Alex Jones. By the way, great interview with Alex Jones. I think you were on with him for about an hour and a half today, maybe even longer. Folks, I would suggest you check that out, too. How long have you been practicing medicine?
I'm in my fourth decade now.
Have you ever seen this phenomenon now where somehow a doctor and a patient have no exclusivity when it comes to treatment or how they want to deal with a disease or a sickness, to now this Orwellian totalitarian approach that everybody's supposed to do the same thing? I've never heard of that.
I've never seen it before. And you know, as a result, patients are needlessly being hospitalized and dying.
And when you talk about that, do you think a lot of that is because of the fear that's been generated from COVID? Where, you know, say 3 years ago, even, you can go back forever, but let's just say 3 years ago, somebody develops a temperature, a headache, whatever, some nausea. Oh, I think I got the flu. I'm going to be in bed a couple days. Maybe I'll take some vitamin C. Maybe I'll ask a doctor if they want to prescribe something. But for the most part, it was, this is pretty run-of-the-mill stuff. I got a flu. I think I'll probably kick it within a week or so of rest and maybe some meds. Now I feel like with all the fear-mongering, people get sick and they think, I've got COVID. I'm going to die. Despite, again, the CDC's numbers, 99.9% survivability rate.
I think fear has a giant amount to do with it, not only on the patient level, as you implied, but also as the doctor and healthcare provider level. I think for the first time in the pandemic, doctors, nurses, and others were afraid of getting the virus themselves. And so that actually influenced a lot of the initial behavior patterns. And then we got into a cycle. And the cycle was basically to retract, don't treat COVID, don't get near it, and just let it progress, let patients just come into the hospital and play defense. And playing defense in a worldwide pandemic is a mistake. This is like a football game. We got to go on offense and go after and treat the virus.
Assuming the healthcare provider practitioner is neutral, how much influence did fear have over the response to this? And how much influence has big pharmaceutical money had over the response to this?
I think most of it's fear. You know, the pharmaceutical money is largely at the level of the pharmaceutical companies. These were pre-purchased arrangements where the government paid for the development. The government pre-purchased the products. The doctors are not marketed. It's not like Pfizer representatives come and market us for their vaccine or others. And our CDC is not, and the FDA has not tipped the hat on which vaccine is the loser and which is the winner. You know, we're a competitive medical market. We're 8 months into this. No report card. Which vaccine is best? How can we give it safely? So because doctors and patients are being stonewalled on vaccine performance, I don't think it's the financial profits behind it that are driving it. I think it's fear and lack of information.
And now they have announced that we won't even get the first clinical studies of the vaccine. The soonest is going to be the year 2023. Some of them don't even get received till the year 2026. There's never been a vaccine that hasn't gone through at least, I would say, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of clinical trials before they release it to the public. And yet they're actually kind of muddying the water here, saying, oh, no, it's approved by the FDA. But apparently that's not true either.
No, not approved. August 23rd, Pfizer not approved. It had extension of the EUA. And then there was a sleight of hand where the conditional approval went to BioNTech, and Comirnaty is the name of the product, which is legally distinct and maybe medicinally distinct from the Pfizer vaccine. So that's BioNTech, the German company. But they have these post-marketing requirements, including studies of myocarditis, et cetera. But your point is, we didn't have a single study that followed a single individual for 2 years to see what would happen. And now we're finding out with, for instance, the Pfizer vaccine, which is the weakest of all the vaccines. It's only 30 micrograms of messenger RNA per dose compared to Moderna, which is 100 micrograms per dose. We have data through multiple sources that Pfizer effectively with Delta has failed as a vaccine. It has less than 50% protection, and it can't last a year. So by definition, it's a non-viable vaccine on the commercial market.
And you know, that's actually incredible you say that, because the effectiveness of the vaccines, as time goes, it's waning. It was 80%, it was 40%, now it's 30%. And so, I mean, I guess eventually it's going to be 0% just based off of that, linear timetable. It's eventually going to be 0%. And that's when they'll come back and say, oh, you need two. oh, you need three. When does it all end? I guess they're admitting it never ends.
Well, it should end. It should end with the decision to defer on a vaccine that honestly is not effective. And a paper by Israel, the first author from Israel, showed that the antibodies drop per month 40%. So that's a marked drop in the vaccine overall antibody effect. There's not much of a T cell effect. Like I said, the overall vaccine effectiveness in the era of Delta is far below 50%. The FDA ruled on the continuation of the EUA just based on the fact that they used legacy data from the other variants, which are now extinct.
Right, and which they're even saying, oh, well, we need booster shots because of the new variants, just like they said for the flu shot. Dr. Peter McCullough is with us for the remainder of this hour. I got a lot more questions for him. Don't go anywhere. Dr. Peter McCullough and I are actually talking free market here during the break, because we've seen Austin boom, we've seen Dallas boom, we've seen Houston boom. That's what the free market does, low taxes. That's why everybody from California is fleeing here. That's why people flee New York City and go to Florida. It's not just the weather. But let's get back into the issue at hand here, and that is COVID, the vaccines. And really, though, I have a more of a general health question for you now, because we have enough data from the CDC that most the COVID deaths were comorbidities, and most people that are being hospitalized for COVID are obese. Now, there's already a problem with obesity in America, but if I showed up to your doctor's office and let's say I was extremely obese and I had high blood pressure and I had low levels of vitamin D and other such things, what would you say to me? What advice would you give to me?
You know, there was a wonderful paper in Circulation in the last year or so. It's one of our better cardiology journals that looked at what's called attributable risk. And it did exactly what you said, organized it to how much could we do better with respect to obesity, hypertension, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, etc. And the answer is a lot. And so if we tomorrow, everyone could drop a few pounds, get fit, it is about the survival of the fittest. Anybody who's had COVID knows COVID's a real stress test for the body. And being out of shape, being obese, having sleep apnea, trouble breathing to begin with, look out. And we know it strikes men more than women.
Well, and that's what I think has been so frustrating. We've had Anthony Fauci in the spotlight for over a year now. I mean, it'll be 2 years, I imagine. Now he says, oh, we'll need lockdowns till spring 2022. So, you know, 2025 or whenever Lord Fauci deems we can be free again. But for all the months and the years that he spent in the spotlight, I've not heard him say one thing about actual health. I've not heard him say one thing about exercise or one thing about stopping smoking or eating healthier and all this stuff. I mean, am I missing it? Have you heard any of this?
We just haven't seen any experts. You know, I'm an academic physician in Dallas, Texas. I have over 750 publications in the National Library of Medicine. I'm the editor of two major journals, senior associate editor of a third, president of a major medical society. I got 45 papers in publication. We have not seen anybody in our health agencies at that level. We don't have experts. We don't have teams of experts organizing our pandemic response. We're dealing with agency staffers who, they have a giant oblivion to prevention of COVID. They have a giant oblivion to the treatment of COVID. When's the last time we had a treatment update? And they have a giant oblivion to vaccine safety and efficacy. When's the last time we've ever had a report card on the vaccines? So our pandemic response, many ways, is suffering from ineptitude.
Well, and that's one of the things I've heard from other doctors as well is, you know, Fauci isn't even really a practicing physician. He's not seen a single COVID patient, not even one.
I'm not convinced that many media doctors, maybe outside of myself, has actually seen and examined COVID patients. I'm actively managing them right now. I published the two major papers in the peer-reviewed literature cited by the National Library of Medicine, the treatment protocols for early COVID-19. You know, our agencies fell flat on what outpatients should do regarding COVID. Outside of getting a test result, there is no offering from our agencies with respect to access to monoclonal antibodies, how to use drugs in sequence combination. And in fact, we have nothing but fear and suffering and anxiety and then late stage hospitalization. That's a terrible way to respond to an illness that gives us 2 to 4 weeks to treat and keep people well.
Well, okay, you heard it there. Owen Schroyer, terrific interview. You know, he's great to work with. I could play more, but time is limited. This does give me a chance to correct one thing I misspoke. I have over 650 publications in the National Library of Medicine and peer-reviewed literature, and then over 45 in COVID-19. Well, we have a terrific show this week. I have a great pleasure in inviting to the show Dr. Michelle Schechter from an obstetrician gynecologist from Sao Paulo, Brazil, but I want her to tell her story about how she dropped what she was doing, go to the interior of Brazil in the Amazon forest to face SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19 illness with the Gamma variant, which is one of the most difficult of all the variants, the Brazilian variant, and her observations on how this was treatable. So it's a terrific show, a great opportunity for our audience to learn more about COVID-19. I do want to point you to our question and answer sessions. We've done now two of them, myself and Malcolm Out Loud, and these should be very good in terms of providing information for you to help you navigate through the COVID-19 trials and tribulations that we'll have, that will face each and every one of us over the next several weeks, months, and hopefully not years to come. So let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
It was a vision that gave birth to a unique multimedia platform that would combine classic talk radio, great writers, and memorable podcasts and videos. AmericaOutLoud.com is a conservative leader in a field that is predominantly run by far-left progressive globalists. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Michelle Schuster. Dr. Schuster received her university training and medical degree in various academic institutions in the São Paulo, Brazil area and its surrounding area. And she undertook a fellowship in obstetrics and gynecology. And she was at the university there for a long time before she's moved into private practice in the city of São Paulo. And I tell you, I've been there myself. It's a huge metropolitan area, very busy, very diverse population. And Michelle's been a leader in COVID-19 and how it's influencing pregnant women, and in particular, the treatment of COVID-19 in pregnant women in order to avoid hospitalization and certainly avoid death of the mother and the baby. Michelle, welcome to McCullough Report.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Peter, for this invite. It's an honor to be talking with you. It's not so easy to treat this disease in Brazil because like in US, we have a lot of doctors being persecuted here. But I'm sure that with a lot of information and good information, you always bring the good information, we can start over this.
Well, we've had a chance to talk to a few doctors in South America, some in Brazilians in Porto Alegre, as well as doctors in Buenos Aires, but really none in the heart of Brazil, in São Paulo. So tell us about how you got involved with treating COVID-19 patients in your practice?
Yes, the first patient that I treat was myself. So I was doing my work at my private clinic at March last year. And then I got bad symptoms. I got a really hard time breathing. In that time, we didn't know so much about the disease. So the first patient that I treat was myself. I got this disease in March last year, and the only medication that we had that time was hydroxychloroquine, and I was with fever, diarrhea, cough, and muscle pain, a lot of muscle pain. And when I took the medication, I got much better in maybe 3 hours. I was with a bad diarrhea, with blood diarrhea. And in 3 hours, I didn't have more fever and I didn't have more diarrhea. And then I started to treat some friends and family and people from my condom. And it started this way. And we had that time, we are not allowed to treat patients when we are out a clinical trial. So I opened a clinical trial just to treat patients. So it started this way.
And what drugs or drug combinations were featured in your clinical trial?
In this first one, it was just hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. And after this, we are working with a lot of other medications like ivermectin, nitazoxanide, budesonide, favipiravir, and blood thickness like heparin and enoxaparin, and vitamins, zinc, vitamin D, and much as the same as your protocol now.
Right. So we really are highlighting to the listeners how doctors in different areas of the world have innovated and come to the principles of using some drugs to reduce viral replication, using some to influence inflammation or cytokine storm, and others to treat the thrombosis or microthrombosis. And when patients have a low oxygen level, oxygen saturation, it's actually microthrombosis, which is almost always the case when we investigate it, especially with respect to autopsy. So have you specifically treated women who are pregnant, let's say first trimester, second trimester, third trimester?
Yes. I went to Manaus, to the heart of Amazon, when we were at the worst crisis over there, COVID crisis. They ran out of oxygen, and I was at the principal, the center maternity over there, and I was with the pregnant ladies at February this year, in the early, when I saw that they are running out of oxygen, I took the first plane, and I went there to save how many lives I could.
Well, that's incredible. So what was it like when you got there?
It was a scary. I have this picture in my memories. It was really scary. In a room, we have like 3 or 4 families. Some of them with symptoms, babies, all of them mixed together. And I started to separate the patients that are with symptoms from the other one that has no symptoms and was there for wrong reasons. So it was really scary for me. And we have really, really bad patients that was never treated for COVID there, with more than 90% of the lungs committed. So was not easy. But we started to use the protocol that we could in the pregnant ladies, and we started to do the prophylaxis with ivermectin in the husbands, and we have a nice response. And I was in TV with a lot of patients getting out of alive with their babies from this maternity, and This was something that was not national reported in Brazil, because we have political conflicts over here, and some politics don't support the treatment. So they try to uncover what happened in Amazon. But when I went there, and I was with 200 doctors that I was helping by telemedicine, for telehealth support for this population, and we could change the reality over there. So after February and the beginning of March 2020, the deaths go down in Amazon just doing the first type of the protocol, just doing antivirals, just doing steroids, just doing blood thickness, just doing what everyone should do in this situation. So we get a good response, and we have the demographic report showing that the deaths end at the middle of February 2020 in Manaus.
So, Michelle, you had COVID-19 and you recovered. When you went there, did you face COVID patients yourself face-to-face? Did you get re-exposed in the setting of taking care of patients?
Yes, I got really exposed. I got really exposed with P1, but I was doing for myself prophylaxis too with ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, because I know it was a different kind of virus, was the P1, not the one that I had before.
Michelle, it was very likely originally you had the wild type virus since you had it so early in the pandemic. But what was described in the Amazon was the Brazilian variant, or the gamma variant, which is, to my knowledge, the gamma variant still is the most deadly of all.
It's really deadly. But with the medications, it's possible to have good response.
But the point I'm making,
if you treat early, you can get, if you treat until day 7, you can get good response. But after this, maybe it's not possible anymore to get the same results. So the key is the early treatment.
Right. So it's key to early treatment. But Michelle, the point I'm making, and I've done this a couple times myself now to make a point, is I personally had COVID-19. I had the British variant because I was in a trial and I was sequenced. And now I've been exposed point blank to the Delta variant in the United States with no mask, no protection, and to really to challenge my immunity and show Americans that I'm immune. And in fact, I am completely immune. You can't get it again with a healthy immune system in the recovery phase. So I think it's really tremendous, your points made that you got it yourself. You started treating your patients when things got really bad in the center of Brazil in the Amazon rainforest. We heard about running out of supplies. You dropped what you're doing. You went there. You helped out, and you made a huge impact in a crisis. And in many ways, even though Brazil is divided in terms of its politics and in terms of the persecution and the challenges that doctors face as they heroically try to take care of patients, what you really showed is that early treatment can get the crisis under control.
Yes. If you don't have a lot of equipment, if you don't have regular oxygen, you can use your old medication to save a life. This is the main key of this treatment. And it's really hard for me to understand why there are some people that don't agree with this. It's medical basis, right? You need to treat early every disease you have, not just this one.
So, Michelle, I have one last question to ask, if you don't mind disclosing. How old are you, and are younger doctors like you starting to become clear that they need to join the early treatment movement?
Oh, I'm 33 years old right now, and I think we have every time more doctors that are recognizing their treatment. So I think it's a question of time, maybe. And I hope in a short time we have more doctors that believe in this treatment.
Well, on that hopeful note, I'll let that be the last word. Thank you for joining us on the McCullough Report.
It's a pleasure of mine to be here. And I thank you so much, Professor Peter, for being in this fight with all of doctors, with all the doctors from the world.
Well, let's get real. Let's get loud on America Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.